Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America College podcast, along with Aaron Fitt. I am John Manuel. This Baseball America College podcast is sponsored by ATEC, the baseball training machine company. ATEC is committed to delivering tools to coaches to help train and develop players. Visit ATECsports.com to learn about training machines that can help make your practice more effective and efficient. See training tips and practice drills from Vanderbilt head coach Tim Corbett and more on ATECsports.com. ATEC, win every practice. And Aaron, I think if Steve Smith of Baylor had been the coach that ATEC had worked with this year, it would be ATEC, win every freaking game. Baylor has won. Baylor's won 24 straight games, 18 straight in the Big 12. And the Battle of the Brazos, the last Battle of the Brazos in Big 12 conference play, goes on this week and this weekend. And first of all, kudos to Baylor Athletics, obviously a women's basketball championship, Heisman Trophy, football team, just all the upswing. And the fans respond in those sports, and the fans responded in baseball this weekend, Aaron. Great crowds down there in Waco. And then kudos to the Baylor baseball team. Biggest challenge of the season so far with A&M, and they sweep the series to extend those win streaks to record proportions for both them and in the Big 12 for consecutive conference games won. What more can you say about the Baylor Bears, Aaron? I'm hoping that you will add to my sense of wonder.
Yeah, it's really awe-inspiring. You know, at this point, they just keep on doing it. And this weekend, yes, it was their big challenge. And you know, I've been pretty outspoken all year about how I thought A&M was the team to beat in the Big 12. And you know, even going into this weekend, I thought A&M was going to win this series because I just thought that Walker and Stripling give them such an advantage in the first 2 days. But you know what, Baylor beat those guys, and it's because they got better pitching. You know, Josh Turley was better than Michael Wacha, and in particular, Trent Blank was better than Ross Stripling, who was very good. He only gave up one run on Saturday, but you know, Trent Blank and Josh Turley are two guys that they don't blow you away with stuff. They don't have nearly the stuff that Wacha and Stripling have, but they just win just like Baylor does. I mean, it's just it's really remarkable. I do think that you know, one point that Steve Smith made this past week in our weekend preview was that, you know, this Baylor team, they don't blow you away in any facet, but if they have one area that's above average, as he put it, it's their offense. And it's because they don't let up 1-9, you know, and I think it helps a lot that Josh Lutie has really had this breakout year as a senior. And, you know, he had all the home runs last week against Kansas State. And then this week he had another home run to kind of get them going on Sunday. You know, you're not going to have a better at-bat than that. A 14-pitch at-bat, fouled off 10 straight pitches, and then hit a home run against Rafael Pineda. I mean, it's, you know, it's guys like that that have just stepped forward. Lawton Langford that have stepped forward this year and really become a very good player. And, you know, Nathan Orff and Dan Evett, who had a big hit on Sunday to give them the lead for good. It's just, you know, a different guy, it seems like, every night. Some of the same guys. But they're a darn good club, and they're playing with incredible confidence right now. And I can't believe that they swept A&M. I mean, you know, it's one thing to win 21 straight against the lesser teams in the Big 12, but I think to sweep A&M is just it takes it to a different level.
It really does. They definitely took it to a different level. 5.5 game lead now in the Big 12, Aaron, and it's hard to imagine. You know, Baylor not being a top eight national seed, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but I just think the ramifications of this sweep need to be taken into account a little bit. And if you look at the rest of Baylor's schedule, you imagine they're going to lose a game here or there. It is baseball. Usually teams lose games. But in the conference, they kind of take a break this weekend. They finish up at Oklahoma, and with a series that's, you know, two-thirds of it are at Texas. And Oklahoma certainly is playing well. You figure with five of your last six games on the road against Oklahoma and Texas, you know, Baylor's probably going to struggle in one of those games. But, I mean, their offense, like you said, like you wrote about, in a year where, you know, we had the midseason trends report come out, either last week or the week before. But the week before, was it not?
I think so.
So about a week and a half ago, so the NCAA's snapshot of Division I baseball and just how offense is basically at last year's levels, even though I thought the anecdotal evidence was that it was, you know, the bats were a little better and offense was up a little bit. The physical, the hard evidence is that it's not. We're at 2011 offensive levels. And when you have a physical, older offensive team like Baylor, and you catch the ball and you're competent at pitching the ball as well, it just seems like it makes such a big difference, Aaron, because they're so much more offensive in their competition.
I completely agree. I think that's a great way of putting it. And, you know, it's starting to seem like that's how you win in college baseball now, is you have a physical, older lineup, and you don't need special pitching. I mean, just look at last year. You know, look at UCLA with Garrett Cole and Trevor Bauer and, you know, I mean, all the arms that they had, and they couldn't hit, and they didn't win a regional. And now, you know, they're older and more physical offensively, and their pitching isn't special, and they're a better team.
Arkansas.
You know, and
look,
I think
at Arkansas, Aaron.
Arkansas is another great example, a team that just isn't really hitting. I mean, I feel like they've got some veterans and they should hit, but for some reason they just don't. And it doesn't even matter how good their pitching is. You know, they're not really winning. They've lost 3 out of 4 series. So I think that's it. I think that it's more important now in college baseball. Look at Central Florida, another team that really stands out for their you know, having a bunch of older guys in the lineup, physical guys. It's an offensive team, and you know, they're really having a great year.
Yeah,
you don't need to be special on the mound anymore, because all you have to do is throw strikes and play catch, and you're going to win.
I couldn't agree more, and I think that we really are seeing that this weekend, but maybe it took this for this weekend for it to really crystallize. But I think you nailed it. You don't have to be special on the mound. You just have to throw strikes and catch the ball, and that's you know, I'm not trying to take anything away from Baylor. I think we're adding to Baylor's resume, and then they're physical and they can score runs, and that makes them very, very dangerous for the postseason. Meanwhile, Texas A&M fall 28-12, 9-6 in the Big 12, fell 7 spots in our rankings. Aaron, is that where we? Yeah, from 2 to 9. Yeah. Could have fallen more. Their resume versus those Pac-12 teams. I think it is very difficult for us to separate those Pac-12 teams, so we didn't separate them. We have them all bunched up. But now, yeah, 5-game losing streak for the Aggies. They've still got to play Texas Tech, and then at Oklahoma State to wrap up league play with one non-conference series. Did A&M's hosting possibilities take a real hit? I mean, they've got a beautiful new facility there. Do the Aggies have a shot to host? Clearly, they're not going to be a top-8 national seed anymore. That's out the window. But how big of a blow is this series sweep?
It's a big blow. There's no doubt about it. You know, all of a sudden, you know, rather than being this team that is at the top of a really poor conference, they're, you know, what are they, 6 games out of first place now? I mean, 5.5. It's a big difference. It's a big difference. And you know, they've got Texas this week. I still think if they win that Texas series, I think they'll be in fine shape to host. But if they lose that Texas series, then no, I don't. You know, I think you're right. I think all of a sudden the hosting thing becomes, all of a sudden that's in jeopardy too. I mean, that's, you know, it's one thing to go lose a series to Baylor, a really good Baylor team, a really hot Baylor team, to get swept by Baylor at the end of an 0-4 week. You know, they also lost that midweek game to Rice. Hey, this team is constructed kind of the opposite of the way Baylor's constructed. You know, we talked about how you don't have to be special and overpowering on the mound, but you need to have physical guys, and A&M doesn't have physicality in their lineup at all. You know, even their best player, Tyler Naquin, he wouldn't use the word physical to describe him. I mean, he can flat-out hit. You know, it doesn't matter that he's not physical. But the rest of their lineup is just not imposing. And, you know, they've got some good players. I mean, certainly I've talked about how much I like Mikey Reynolds and, you know, Matt Yingle's a good player, and Jacob House. But, I mean, it's this lineup isn't nearly the lineup that Baylor has. And it just really stood out this weekend. And not that those were, you know, these weren't dominating wins by Baylor. I mean, it was a couple of 2-run games and a 1-run game. You know, they could have gone either way. But all 3 of them, I think, could have gone either way. But, you know, Baylor showed a knack for getting the big hits at the right time, and maybe a little bit more mental toughness there.
Yeah, I think that's one of the stats that you have in the top 25 tracker. 13 of Baylor's 24 wins have been decided by 1 or 2 runs, of the 24 straight wins, including 11 of the last 15. So they really have a knack for winning that close game. And Aaron, just as I'm sketching out regional host clubs, it really does feel like that Texas Tech A&M series winner has a huge leg up, but it does not feel like the Big 12 is going to get three hosts. It feels like it's definitely a two-host league. Any chance Oklahoma can jump up there to be that team? Or I suppose Oklahoma State's making a run, but you don't see that? Is it really pretty much as a Longhorn to the Aggies?
As the second host, I think. I mean, there's no way. I don't think Oklahoma can get up that high. Although, you know, it looked like the series this weekend against Alabama State didn't give Oklahoma the kind of RPI hit that maybe I thought it would. I think they're still they're still in the top 60 or so, roughly. It seems like in the pseudo RPI. So that's actually good news for Oklahoma. At least they swept that series. I mean, a loss to one of those games would have really hurt them. I think they're looking in good shape now for an at-large spot, at least, because they've gotten hot at the right time. And, they're number 55 in the RPI, so they're doing all right.
It's the Baseball America College Podcast with John Manuel and Aaron Fitt. Aaron, so we talked about Baylor with a 5.5-game lead in the Big 12, vaulting up to number 3 in the rankings this weekend. But Florida State still number one, 24-game win streak or not for Baylor. We can't jump them over Florida State, considering the Seminoles are 19-2 in the Atlantic Coast Conference, have not lost a series all year, and 33-7. Still our number one team. Really the only blemish for them is the two midweek losses basically to Florida. Otherwise, Aaron, Florida State's been close to perfect, and obviously a pretty big weekend when you're Florida State, when you can sweep Miami. We'll talk about the Hurricanes and their struggles in a minute. An injury-depleted Miami team this weekend, but so what can you do if you're a Florida State? You just take care of business, and that's what they did. Two dominating wins, and then their bullpen comes through on Sunday in a close game, as does their offense. Florida State just kind of steady as she goes there, and even with James Ramsey slumping at least a little bit, just coming back to earth a little bit over the last month or so, Florida State just keeps on dominating, and they have a 6-game lead now in the Atlantic Coast Conference. I mean, they're about as locked for a top 8 national seed as any team in the country, aren't they?
Oh yeah, there's no doubt about it. Especially since I don't feel like the remaining schedule really presents a lot of challenges at this point. I mean, I think they just got a stranglehold right now over the ACC. You don't see a team win the ACC with this kind of distance. It's we see it once in a while. I feel like in the Big 12, you see one of these runaway teams like Baylor's doing this year. We've seen Texas do that before. But in the ACC, to have a 6-game lead over everybody else in the league, it's just unusual, you got to give it to Florida State. They've won games a lot of ways, and I was interested to see how they would respond this weekend in a series that I think they really should have won. I think they're clearly better than Miami and certainly healthier than Miami. But, they had that little hiccup last Sunday. They got blown out by Boston College.
Right.
I think it was important that Florida State show that was just an aberration, as we thought it was. And we left them number one last week, didn't put a whole lot of stock in that game. And, they did take care of business against Miami. And, we've talked a lot about Florida State, I think, this year. But I think we both like their club. And they've gotten some new faces kind of stepping forward. This weekend they had another freshman, Holland, I think it was. John Holland, had a nice game in support of another freshman, Mike Compton, on Saturday. So, I mean, it seems like they've had a lot of different guys contribute at Florida State.
Yeah, and then Holland had another big game on Sunday. So it seems like they keep coming up with new guys. And, the 7-run inning for Miami on Sunday and Florida State it seems to me that's their biggest strength, is that they were just completely unfazed by anything that other teams do. It feels like they pretty much worry about themselves. That's the way that coaches tell teams, worry about what you can control, that kind of stuff. They seem like they're that kind of team. And again, I think that goes to, with the exception of their pitching staff, they are pretty much a veteran team. I mean, we talked about their veteran infield all year. We're just talking about some freshman contributions, but when push comes to shove, Aaron, they're veteran bullpen, veteran infield, obviously the senior leader and Ramsey out in center field. This team doesn't get rattled and doesn't panic. And again, they're that older physical team that allows them to have success in the BB Core era.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that makes a big difference. They did also have a freshman shortstop. I think the big key we'll see now is how serious, I guess, his injury is, the Justin Gonzalez. He left Sunday's game after only one at bat. I haven't seen a report on his health. I just noticed that in the box score yesterday on my phone, and we'll see how he, you know, because you could ill afford to lose a veteran shortstop who, you know, is as physical and offensive and consistent defensively as Gonzalez is. But, I mean, obviously Florida State has some cushion, as we talked about, six-game cushion in the ACC. The two second-place teams overall in the league behind them, Aaron, are North Carolina and NC State. North Carolina with a series loss this weekend at home to Georgia Tech. Let's focus on the positive aspect of that first. That is Georgia Tech, obviously, with the positive. Georgia Tech was 7-11 coming in to the weekend in the league. 9-12 still isn't great, but that's got to be a pretty big boost for Georgia Tech. Does that put them from off the bubble to off the bubble for the tournament to in the tournament on the better side of the bubble now, Aaron?
I think so. Yeah, I think you'll see that switch probably in tomorrow's stock report, with Maryland probably sliding back out after they got swept this weekend by somebody. Who did they play? Was it Wake?
It was
Clemson. Right. Maryland was swept by Clemson this weekend. So, you know, that probably hurts Maryland and helps Georgia Tech. And, you know, Georgia Tech helped itself, more importantly. It really, really needed that series. That Coastal Division is a little bit of a muddle. I mean, North Carolina slides into first place by itself, kind of by default, as Miami gets swept. And, you know, it seems like these teams are just beating up on each other now. I mean, Virginia is up and down, it seems like. They did get swept by North Carolina last week. They bounced back this week, won a series at Duke. You know, they have swept Wake Forest, which, and it's, you know, Wake's had its own
ups and downs.
Its own ups and downs. I mean, it, you know, last week it beat Georgia Tech, which just beat North Carolina, and I mean, you know, Clemson, and it's just this is one of those leagues where if you try to use the transitive property to figure out who's best, you're going to drive yourself crazy because they're all beating up on each other.
With the exception of Florida State, the very notable exception
right.
of Florida State, feels like next weekend, Aaron, this Clemson Georgia Tech series is just going to be huge. Very quietly, because they haven't been in the rankings. Clemson's gotten hot. And they did have the series loss at home to NC State, which, you know, is one of the big reasons why NC State feels like they're, you know, kind of, you know, secure. Again, tied for second in the league. They're very secure of being in the tournament. But Clemson's now only one game behind NC State and North Carolina at 12-9. These back-to-back sweeps of, a sweep this week, I should say, of Maryland. Before that, they swept that series at Duke. So they've swept a couple of road series, granted against kind of, you know, not top teams, but, you know, Virginia couldn't sweep Duke on the road. We've had a couple other teams that have gone to Maryland and haven't fared well in the league. Talk a little bit about Clemson. I mean, we had them as a preseason top 25 team. Are they starting to – what's helped them right the ship a little bit? And are they – could they put themselves into a – let's say they're going to make the tournament now. Could they do anything to put themselves in the hosting conversation?
I don't see it. I think they're too big of a hole to dig out of. I mean, I suppose, if they pull a Baylor here and don't lose again, then yeah,
right.
they'll probably host. But
right.
I mean, you know, the series, the schedule ahead does give them opportunities. You know, they have Florida State at home. You know, if they let's say they win that series, let's say they, you know, they go to Georgia Tech next week and win that series, and they also have a road series against Wake Forest. So I mean, that's the thing. For Clemson, the schedule does open up a little bit with opportunities, I should say. I mean, it doesn't get really easy for them.
Right.
I think it's a more challenging finishing stretch than a lot of ACC teams have. They also have three against College and Charleston, which is a quality series. You know, at this point, I think Charleston is looking like a potential two seed in a regional. I mean, that kind of a year. They're having a nice year. So, you know, it's the opportunity is there for Clemson. They need to get hot, and you know, they've been playing better of late, certainly. You know, Duke and NC State, or Duke and Maryland, rather, nice road sweeps for them. They did lose that home series against NC State last weekend. So every time you start to get excited about Clemson, it seems like they take a step back. But
but
there's some nice things on their resume now. They are going to be in regional, it sure seems like, barring a real collapse here. I don't know. I mean, I still don't think that they're a great team. I mean, I think they're okay. But they've gotten, I think, better production of late from the bottom half of their order, which had been kind of a gaping hole. This weekend, John McGibbon and Spencer Keboom and, you know, Brad Felder and Jason Stoltz, those guys, I think they had better weekends, which is going to be a key for Clemson because they just, you know, they need more production out of those guys.
To me, Aaron, it seems like the defining characteristic about the ACC is that just outside of Marcus Stroman, who was on the last place or second to last place team in the league, there's not a dominant Friday starter in this league. There's some there's some pretty good Friday starters. Ken Emanuel is obviously pretty good, but North Carolina has lost four of his last five starts. You know, NC State's best starter doesn't start on Fridays. Carlos Rodon goes on Saturdays. Florida State doesn't have a Sean Gilmartin. It's just the whole staff there is solid in the bullpen. You know, Kevin Brady is good for Clemson, but he has one win. Wake Forest, Tim Cooney is good, but he's kind of like Stroman. He's really good, but he's on a team that's just okay. There's just not a dominant Friday. You know, Florida, Virginia, Brendan Klein, good, although we saw him bad this weekend here, but he can't carry a team. They're just, there's real, you know, Marcus Stroman to me is so far and away the best Friday guy in this league. It's not a lot of aces in the ACC. It's just more, it really stands out. I guess Buck Farmer, if I had to pick the second best Friday starter in the ACC, I might pick Buck Farmer.
You might be right too. I mean, you know, I think Brandon Liebrand has been really actually consistent for Florida State. I mean, he's just a freshman, you know, and he doesn't blow you away. But if you look at the numbers, they're probably up there pretty good. He's beaten a lot of good teams and matched up with people. But you're right. I mean, I think you know, on paper you'd think maybe it might be Emanuel, but he hasn't been results wise. And you know, Farmer, I think that's probably the choice. I think it is Buck Farmer.
By default, Buck Farmer. Congratulations. And then poor Dusty Isaacs. I should never show up to a Dusty Isaacs start again. I saw him against NC State, and I don't think he lasted four innings in that one. Then I saw him against North Carolina on Saturday, and he gave up eight runs in the first, and that was a hoochie mama kind of game. Not good.
And I'll make one more interjection here. I think probably the best Friday starter in the league besides Stroman is pitching on Saturdays. It's Carlos Rodon.
I like
the way they set up their rotation.
You know, I love Marcus Stroman, and I know this is a loud statement. I'd take Carlos Rodon over Marcus Stroman right now and for the future. And I'm not trying to knock Marcus Stroman in any way, shape, or form. He's awesome. I just think Carlos Rodon is better. So.
I don't think he's better right now. I mean, if I had to win a game tomorrow, I would still take the veteran.
I'd take the fearless lefty. It would be close.
Okay.
I would love to watch that game, and I wish that NC State would just go ahead and throw Rodon on Fridays so we could see that happen, because that's next weekend, or this coming weekend, Duke and NC State, and I want to see that game on Friday. I want it to be Stroman against Rodon, and let's see it go mano a mano. But I can guarantee you, I think that's the first time we've talked Duke NC State baseball on the Baseball America College podcast, which is sponsored, by the way, by ATEC, the baseball training machine company. ATEC is committed to delivering tools to coaches to help train and develop players. Visit ATECsports.com to learn about training machines that can help make your practice more effective and efficient. See training tips and practice drills from Vanderbilt head coach Tim Corbett and more on ATECSports.com. ATEC, win every practice. Speaking of Vanderbilt, Aaron, let's go to the Southeastern Conference. The big showdown was Kentucky against LSU, and the Wildcats win it again. I don't know what else we could really say about Kentucky, but it sounds like it was a pretty great series, pretty even series. And between Kentucky, LSU, Florida, and South Carolina, we've got four SEC teams right there ensconced in our top seven. And it feels like, other than Kentucky, Aaron, the hottest team there is South Carolina, which kind of, you know, don't look now, but the Gamecocks have won four straight series in the league. And a guy like Grayson Griner, they're, you know, we talked about NC State's freshman class. South Carolina's freshman class, which was kind of their problem when they first got into SEC play, starting to become part of the solution.
You're right. And Tanner English has been playing well also. I think he had a four-hit game on Sunday. Yeah, I think South Carolina is coming together, you know, and it's kind of quietly now. They're, what are they, 31-11 or something like that? I mean, it's been a little under the radar because they didn't get off to a great start. It's kind of like Rice, though. I mean, both those teams,
great,
you look up and all of a sudden they're, you know, they've won 75% of their games and they're sitting pretty, you know. And it, sometimes it just takes a little while, but then they kind of quietly find their groove. And you know, with both those teams, I think it's helped some moves here or there. And in South Carolina's case, certainly moving Jordan Montgomery into that Saturday job has been a masterstroke by Ray Tanner. We're used to that from him, just like we're used to those kind of brilliant midseason moves from Paul Maneri and at LSU. And, you know, those guys are great coaches, and they find ways to put their players in the best position to succeed. But I certainly agree that South Carolina's come on strong. I mean, and you're right, what more can you say about Kentucky? That was the marquee series this weekend, two top five teams. Kentucky just, their resume is so impressive. I can't get over it. Now that they've won series against South Carolina, Ole Miss and LSU at home, they won road series against Arkansas and Georgia and Tennessee. I mean, it's just they don't stop winning. You know, they're like Baylor. You every time you think maybe this is the weekend they have a hiccup, it's not. They just keep going out there and doing it. And you know, they're just a, again, they're a very complete team. There's not a real hole you can point to, you know, with Kentucky, except for maybe their starting pitching has been a little up and down, but it was better this weekend. Jared Grundy was better, which they needed on Saturday.
Grundy pitch.
Nice.
I'm sorry. Been holding it in for several weeks. Couldn't hold it in anymore.
I'm proud of you, John, for holding it in as long as you did. But
thank you very much. I can't even speak. I got a little verklempt. But, yeah, I mean, but you talked about it for Kentucky. I did want to dwell on South Carolina for a minute. The crazy thing to me is, Aaron, I really thought South Carolina, I mean, we knew they'd pitch well this year, and they have, and they pitched quite well. They're not off, they haven't maintained that crazy early season pace. But I thought they'd be a little bit more offensive club this year. But again, the reason I want to bring it up is it plays into what we talked about these veteran teams. I guess that's why I don't put anything past Coach Tanner and the Gamecocks with back-to-back national championships. Why would you? But you look at their numbers, and they're not a particularly offensive club. And I think it is because they're so young. It feels like a guy like an Adam Matthews and LB Dantzler, and Matthews has been struggling all year. But, you know, Dantzler, you know, had a home run this weekend. He's tied for their team lead. I feel like those two guys are going to have to be the ones to help carry this team in the postseason, because I just don't feel like in this era that a bunch of freshmen can lead you to a national championship unless those freshmen are just spectacular freshmen. And I feel like South Carolina's freshmen are quite good. I just don't feel like they're spectacular.
Yeah. And you know, I don't know if it's something we've talked about on the podcast or not. I know it's something we've talked about on or off the podcast, but it's so striking to me, the difference between college baseball and college basketball, where you have these one and done teams like Kentucky, filled with freshmen, just really talented guys that can come in and out-talent everybody and win the national title.
Right.
You're never going to see that in college baseball.
No, I think you're right.
Because you have to mature physically. You know, it's just not one of those games where freshmen are going to come in and dominate. You have to adjust to the longer season, and that's a big adjustment, going from 30-odd games to 56 just in the regular season before you even get to the postseason. You know, and certainly the overall jump in the speed of the game, in the quality of the pitchers you're facing for hitters. I mean, you have to be stronger physically, and that's why so many guys take such leaps as sophomores and juniors. But I agree with you. You know, it's South Carolina. You've got Christian Walker. You know, the whole thing is built around him. He's an experienced veteran guy. You know, he's like their Max Muncy, if you want to compare them to Baylor. I mean, he's probably better than Max Muncy.
Right.
But, you know, he's in the same mold. They're both very similar guys in that respect. But other than that, I mean, you know, Dantzler's got some physicality. But, I mean, you know, I like Evan Marzilli a lot. He's an experienced older player. But, you know, he's been streaky throughout the course of his career. I mean, this is not an offense that's going to scare you. But, you know, it wasn't an offense that scared anybody last year or the year before that. The difference was that I do think they were a little older, you know, in the lineup the previous 2 years. I think they were a little better offensively the previous 2 years.
Right.
So, I agree with you that they've been a little disappointing offensively so far.
Yeah, and then let's talk about the rest of the Southeastern Conference, Aaron, because this league, obviously, I mean, it's almost like now it's a minimum 8 teams are going to get in from the SEC, maybe more, but, you know, the SEC East, obviously these three behemoths, Kentucky, Florida, South Carolina, all are obviously in the tournament. All of them are almost locks to be hosts in my mind, and all of them are in the running to be top 8 national seeds. I don't think all three of them will be, but more than likely two of them will be. And then you look at the West, Aaron. You got LSU, and then you know a couple of Arkansas and Ole Miss that played each other this weekend. And Arkansas, we've kind of touched on. I think you've written about them. They lose that series to Ole Miss this weekend. I guess I'm wondering. You know, usually the SEC is a 4 or 5 regional hosts. Is there a fifth team out there in the SEC? You're probably going to look at this more in the stock report. Obviously, at this time of year, kind of the podcast turns into a stock report preview. But Arkansas, Ole Miss, does that series win give Arkansas? Give Ole Miss the leg up on those two teams? If there is a fifth team, or is there going to be more to the? Are the resumes similar enough? I guess I should say that Ole Miss. And that gives Ole Miss a leg up in hosting a regional?
Yeah, I think so. And I thought that would be the case heading into the weekend. I thought that whichever team won that series would kind of take control of the race for a fifth host. Because you're right, LSU, Kentucky, Florida, South Carolina, I think are all going to host. That seems very safe. Those are all all those teams ranked in the top 7 now in our rankings. But I think this league is strong enough that it has a real chance to get a fifth one. And I think it is Ole Miss, because certainly if you're comparing Ole Miss and Arkansas, the Rebels have the much more impressive resume to me. I mean, the fact that they now have – first of all, they have the series head-to-head win against Arkansas, but they also have that big series win against Florida that does loom large.
Right.
I mean, Ole Miss is – they haven't played great on the road, but they didn't get swept at Kentucky. You know, they didn't get swept at Georgia after they lost the first two games. You know, so we talk about the importance of winning series at home and not getting swept on the road in the SEC. That's really the formula there, and they've done that. I mean, they haven't gone above and beyond that, but they've beaten good teams at home, very good teams. So I certainly think they've got the more impressive resume than Arkansas. And if they can keep it going and not fall apart here, I mean, you know, the schedule isn't that bad for Ole Miss. You know, they're at Mississippi State this weekend, a series that I'll see at least part of. Then they've got LSU at home. Again, they've played very well at home. They're a great home team. They've got such a great home field advantage at Swayze with that atmosphere. You know, they're drawing 11,000 fans for a game. I mean, that's insane. And then they've got Tennessee at home, and they're at Vanderbilt, which clearly is a beatable team, even on the road. I mean, Vanderbilt fell on his face this week against Alabama. You know, they had an opportunity. They're starting to play better, and then you lose to the worst team in the league. I mean, that's bad. Maybe Vanderbilt's the worst team in the league.
It's very possible, Aaron. And I mean, you wrote last week, actually, I kind of dismissed Vanderbilt as a regional team. And then you wrote about just how tough their schedule had been, 2-13 against teams in the RPI top 25, not top 50, top 25, which I think was just a killer schedule. But now you're looking at Vanderbilt losing that weekend series. I can't even find them in the RPI. I don't see them in the top 60 of the RPI. So even if they – well, there they are. They're at 66. So even if they finish with a 500 record, which is very hard for them to do, they're probably not going to get an at-large bid. Alabama, I think we can say, is out. They're 9 games under 500.
Auburn, yeah, they're 145 in the RPI. Alabama is. So
right.
I mean.
So the tide's out. Auburn is on the precipice, that sweep by South Carolina. You know, the rest of their schedule looks very tough. They're only 2 games over 500 in the league. Home to Tennessee, that's a big bubble series to watch this weekend. Tennessee's RPI is around 60. You know, the Vols, Dave Serrano's got them in the hunt for an at-large bid, but they have to win that series, I think, at Auburn if they're going to, you know, be in position. And Auburn's the Tennessee and Florida series to bookend their next 4 weekends are at home in the middle at Georgia, at Arkansas. That's not going to be easy. So Auburn, you know, really has to finish strong. And even Mississippi State's not necessarily securely in, Aaron.
Right.
So, and we talk about the SEC as a, you know, 8 teams feel like their birthright. I still feel the rest of the bubble is soft enough that they're going to be 8 SEC teams in and maybe a 9th. But it's certainly not a done deal. Am I correct in saying that? Or is it a done deal that there's you feel like they're secure with 9?
I think they're going to get 9 because, as you said, the bubble is soft. And I feel like it seems like we've been saying that every year now for the last few years. The bubble is soft, and then, you know, some teams, some conference favorites in these mid-majors get upset in their tournaments, and all of a sudden there's less at-large bids to go around than you thought there were, and the SEC doesn't get as many teams as you expect. I mean, that's happened the last few years. The SEC hasn't gotten as many teams as we thought it would. You know, last year, LSU getting left out.
Right.
Was it 2 years ago that Kentucky was on the wrong side of the bubble, ultimately?
Feels like there's been an SEC team on the wrong side the last couple of years. You're right.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's something to think about. But I'll tell you, back to Vanderbilt for 1 second, you know, hypothetically, if they did, I still think that if they can win, finish above 500 overall, which is a huge if, but if they could do that, I still think they would get in because look at the teams still in their schedule. They've got Kentucky, at LSU, Ole Miss, and Tennessee. Those are really good RPI teams. I mean, their RPI will climb if they can, in fact, finish above 500 overall. But they're not going to because they're not good enough. They're not going to win all those series.
It's a great point. I think it's an important point. The bottom line is they're just not good enough. RPI or not, they're just not good enough. It's the Baseball America podcast with John and Aaron. Aaron, lastly, you talked about the transitive property earlier in the show. The Pac-10 is the enemy of the transitive property just as much as the ACC is. I'll get used to saying Pac-12 here sometime soon, I promise, but that day has not yet happened. Aaron, Arizona leading the Pac-12 now, but UCLA, Oregon, Stanford, Oregon State, all one loss back, which is kind of crazy, as is Washington State. I should not leave the Cougs out of this. Especially since you always call me Johnny Cougs, so I love the Cougs. But Stanford, to me, is the story of the weekend in the Pac-12, Aaron. It feels like Stanford got its groove back. They found that young thing to help get their groove back. I can't believe I just made a Stella got her groove back reference there. But that young thing is Alex Blandino, the great Blandino. And Stanford, all of a sudden, the Cardinal offense is back, baby. They score 34 runs. And a weekend at Arizona State where, yeah, it's an offensive ballpark. I mean, that wasn't even at Arizona State, was it? That was at home, wasn't it?
That's right, it was at home.
And they punished a pitching staff that has really been punishing opponents. So besides Alex – well, tell us a little bit about Alex Blandino. What was kind of his what's his background as far – I talked to Dean Stotts a couple weeks ago, and he told me Blandino's going to be a stud. He's the next guy. But what led to him being in the lineup, and how is Stanford? How does Stanford's offense break out this weekend?
Well, you know, it broke out. You're right. I mean, partly because of Blandino. I mean, he just had a huge weekend, a bunch of 3-hit games, home runs. I mean, he's really kind of come into his own here, and you know, he's a guy that was a big recruit for them. He's very talented, you know, and coming into the year. He was kind of an X factor for them, and the problem is they didn't really have a spot for him because they just were so good and so deep offensively. But, he kind of started to force his way into the lineup even before Lonnie Coppola got hurt. He was playing some and, kind of a DH sort of a role. And then this weekend, they're without Lonnie Coppola, who, at shortstop, so they slide Kenny DeKroger to short. They put Duran at second base. They put Blandino at third, and they moved Piscotty to left field. Now, Blandino is a guy that, you know, I've had scouts tell me he's going to be a first-round pick in 3 years. I mean, it's a legit, talented guy who's got a really short swing and just knows how to hit. You know,
he's a local guy. He's a San Jose guy, so kind of the Stanford allure was pretty strong, it sounds like, with him.
Right, exactly. You know, and he's very talented, and I think he's a good defensive third baseman as well. Kind of gives him an upgrade there, frankly, because Piscotty hadn't been great defensively at third base. It was the right move, and it's given them a lift. I wonder about their pitching. It's still a question mark for them. I mean, it sounded like Appel pitched okay this weekend, but after that big outing a week ago where he threw 149 pitches, it sounded like he labored a little bit this week.
What a shock.
Stuff wasn't as electric. I mean, Brady Rogers apparently wasn't good either from what I heard, but he got lit up. But they moved A.J. Venegas back to the bullpen where originally I think they kind of hoped he could make a good closer, and maybe that's going to be his role. I mean, he'd seemed like he'd found a home in the rotation, that Sunday spot. He pitched well there the last – week or two, I think.
Right.
But, you know, he pitched in Saturday's game and Sunday's game against the Sun Devils. Pitched very, very well in both games. And they needed somebody to stabilize the bullpen so they didn't have to, you know, leave their ace out there for 149 pitches. So I guess that's a good thing if he can hold down that role. They, you know, that then leaves them with a hole on Sunday, though. And John Hochstatter only went 4 2/3 on Sunday. So, I mean, their pitching still leaves something to be desired. It's still not a dominant pitching staff. But if their offense can produce like it did this weekend, like it did early in the year, then it probably won't matter.
It's really amazing to me when you look at their staff, because outside of Appel and Mooneyham, who are two, you know, experienced power arms on the weekend, both those guys have a lot of strikeouts. The rest of their staff, they just don't strike anybody out. It is, you know, but again, that doesn't seem to matter if you throw strikes. Throw strikes. You know, my Wayne Graham impersonation is pretty much just throw strikes or I got to go wash my soaps. You know, that's pretty much it. but they don't throw enough strikes, it appears, Aaron, especially A.J. Venegas does not throw enough strikes, I guess, to be that weekend star. And that's why they value Hochstatter, because the major, I guess it's actually General Hochstatter on Hogan's Heroes. The general does throw strikes generally. But yeah, it's an unusual club. They're about where we thought, maybe a little bit less of what we thought they'd be, you know, in terms of their record, and they haven't quite dominated the Pac-12 like maybe we thought they would. And they're doing it in an unusual way. In some ways, that some of the players haven't quite stepped forward. I mean, Blandino leads the team in home runs with 60 at bats. He's got the 6 home runs. I mean, as physical as the rest of their team is, and the fact that guys like Wilson and Stewart and Piscotty, you know, have hit some home runs, Regira have shown some power, but Blandino's got more home runs than all those guys. It's been an unusual year for the Cardinal. And then, like you said, then you have Brett Michael Duran, who's kind of moved into the spot at second in place of Coppola, and he's starting to contribute a little bit. So their depth has come into play in a positive way. So just a very unusual year for Stanford in terms of who's getting it done, but I still feel like they're an Omaha team in terms of talent. Do you still feel that way, or do those questions about the pitching make you wonder if they're still an Omaha team?
Oh, I mean, I certainly think they certainly can be an Omaha team. They're definitely good enough to. And I think back to last year, you know, and the fact that that team peaked at the right time. In regionals, they looked fearsome. And you know, they at that point in the season, you thought they could beat anybody. And I wouldn't be surprised if that happens again this year. I mean, I would have thought that they'd be able to kind of maintain that higher level of play throughout the season because they're older. But that hasn't been the case, but, you know, if they peak at the right time, that's what matters, and they're certainly capable of doing that.
Yeah, they're going to have to. This weekend at UCLA, at Oregon State, the weekend after that, then finally the last 3 weeks' schedule at least eases up a little bit as they're home to Washington State, at Utah, and then home to Cal. Nothing's going to be easy, nor should it be in the Pac-12, Aaron. You know, I mentioned Wazoo a little bit earlier. Big weekend series win for Wazoo at Oregon. Now they've already played Utah. I don't mean to pick on the Utes, but they are the, you know, last place team in the league, and you kind of need to sweep them when you play them. And Wazoo wasn't quite able to do that. Did this weekend put Wazoo back in the regional discussion by going to Oregon, which has, I still think, the best overall resume in the Pac-12? Does that series win put the Cougars back in the discussion?
They're back in the discussion, but they certainly have a lot of work still to do. They're still in the mid-70s in the RPI, and
right.
You know, it helped. They really needed that series. And coming into the year, we thought Washington State would be a regional team, and their pitching has been, I think, by and large, poor this season. But they pitched better this weekend, I think. But they won it with their offense. I mean, this is an offensive team. That's how they're going to have to win a lot of games. You know, they 8-3, 10-6 are the two games that they won against Oregon, and it's a good Oregon pitching staff. But you know, it's a really experienced, you know, quality Washington State offense, and they could slug their way into a regional. But there's not a lot of margin for error. You know, and the schedule isn't easy. I mean, they have Arizona State coming up. They got Cal, then at Stanford, Oregon State. I mean, it's you know, they got to get hot, and they could, but The Pac-12 is like you said before, it's kind of a muddle. You know, we're looking for a seventh kind of regional team in that league after Arizona, UCLA, Oregon, Stanford, Oregon State. Well, really, you're looking at right now, I think, five teams that are pretty safe.
Right.
Arizona State can't play in a regional. So after that, you know, who's going to be the sixth and or seventh team? You know, Washington State, Cal, Washington, USC, all in the mix. But none of those teams have really separated themselves yet. So that's something to watch for the stretch run.
Feels like it should be Cal in terms of talent. Feels like, you know, in fact, they went to Omaha last year. I know their pitching is quite thin. Just feels like Cal should be that sixth team to me here. And UW hasn't won a Pac-10 series in a month. Cal did take care of business this weekend by sweeping Utah. They won that head-to-head against UW. I know they lost the series at Southern Cal. Just feels like, you know, they also have that star on their resume of having gone to Texas and won that series. I know there's some other things on there, but it just feels like that should be Cal. They also lost the series to Long Beach State, Aaron, and that brings me to the Big West. Real quickly, I mean, the Big West is no-hitterville with Andrew Thurman of Long Beach State. And Long Beach State, I guess, Aaron, is kind of the sneaky team to watch for regionals because they're still tied for first in the Big West with Fullerton. And it feels like, you know, Long Beach State probably not going to get an at-large since they're under 500 right now, and they've just been hovering around that mark all year. But if they got a shot to win the Big West, do you think they can win the Big West? It feels like if they could take care of business against Northridge, Davis, and Pacific, all winnable series for them, they don't even have to win that series with Fullerton to they may not have to win that series to win the league.
Yeah, I think they probably will because, you know, it's not the Big West is such that it's not like anyone's going to really challenge Fullerton between now and the last weekend either. I mean, they've got Pacific, Santa Barbara, and Riverside, and there are just not a lot of good teams in this league. I think it will ultimately come down to that last weekend. But, you know, Long Beach does have a chance to get an at-large even if it doesn't win this thing because if they can finish over 500, their RPI isn't bad. I mean, it's, you know, mid-50s right now.
Yeah.
They're in the neighborhood, and they've really gotten hot at the right time. I think they've won, what, five straight series now, starting with at Wichita State, at Cal Poly, at Riverside, so three road series in a row, then home against Santa Barbara and Irvine. Showed a lot this weekend by coming back to win a series after getting no hit on Friday. I think they won in walk-off fashion, I believe, on Saturday against Irvine, you know, and then which kind of turned the tables on the teams, what teams have been doing to them all year long. I mean, Long Beach, rather, has lost a ton of heartbreakers this season.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy. So, you know, this team's been through it, and they played a tough schedule early on. Like you said, they beat Cal 2 out of 3 very early. They went up to Oregon and got swept and then came home, played Arizona State. They had Fullerton in a non-conference. So, I mean, they've played a very rigorous non-conference schedule, and they're still around 500. They're playing well in the league. You look at their talent, and it doesn't really impress you. They're a very mediocre offensive team, kind of par for the course in that conference.
One home run. I know they play at Blair Field, but one home run? Come on.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm just throwing this out there. I expect Johnny Bekakis to drop a home run sometime. How good is Johnny Bekakis?
I don't know that he's a home run hitter. I mean, it's just not the identity of this team.
Oh,
they're
my God.
Obviously.
Come on, throw me a bone here. His name is Bekakis. That's a great name. We don't even have to.
Nafaskata, Johnny.
This is a family podcast. You watch your mouth. We've gone off the rails of the Baseball America College podcast. But last, Aaron, I do want to talk a little bit about Conference USA because kind of like some of these other leagues. You know, we're talking about the Big 12 where we've been searching for that fourth regional team. It looks like it's going to be Oklahoma. Talking about the Pac-12 where we're searching for like that lock sixth team, SEC, like which bubble team wants to come forward there. In Conference USA, it feels like UCF, Rice, which the Golden Knights now lead the league. Kudos to them. Back-to-back series wins against Southern Miss and then sweeping Tulane this weekend. In New Orleans, that's not always easy to do. Tulane had been playing well. I had a couple people in the Southeast tell me, like, you know, Tulane's a little bit better than you're giving them credit for. You know, better than their, you know, I had coaches in that league tell me that, you know, Tulane's better than their 92 RPI. One coach told me, you know, Tulane's going to win that series. I think Tulane's going to beat UCF. No, UCF goes out there and sweeps it. It looks like they're positioning themselves, Aaron, as a regional host, which would be a first, I guess, for the Golden Knights.
You're right. Right now, you know, you got to figure they probably passed Miami in the pecking order in that state. Miami's been up and down. Now they're banged up. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, the competition for those last few regional host spots is going to be tight. But certainly Central Florida has taken care of business now the last 2 weeks. Winning those road series against Southern Miss and Tulane back-to-back, really big series for both of those teams. I mean, for Southern Miss and Tulane, if they were going to make a run at regionals, I think they kind of needed to beat UCF, and they couldn't do it. You know, the Knights have been winning games with their pitching in addition to their bats. I think the fact that they lost a 16-inning, one-nothing game last week against Southern Miss, and then they come back and win a 1-0 game this Friday against Tulane. And then, you know, in each case, they went and outslugged and kind of bashed the other team on Friday and Saturday. This is an offensive team, but I think their pitching is peaking at the right time as well.
Yeah, and then Rice, as you've written about and you've talked about with either to me or on the podcast, you just feel like it's another Rice second half revival that's on its way, and they're certainly playing that way. And then East Carolina, you know, again, we've heard nothing but really solid things about East Carolina. They're just not a series win where you could kind of hang your hat on ECU to have put them in the rankings yet. They did lose their series at UCF, and they did lose the series at Rice. Maybe if they'd had one of those games, one of those series at home, and had won one, they'd probably be in the rankings. But you know, they've got still have Tulane left, and they still have to go to Southern Miss. But it feels like East Carolina is a very secure, very solid third best team in this league. Is there a fourth regional team in Conference USA right now?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, you thought maybe Tulane had a chance, but for Tulane to make a run, they just, you know, they had to start winning series against these good teams, and they lost the Rice series a couple weeks ago. They got swept now by UCF. I mean, I suppose if they go to East Carolina and win that series, if they beat Southern Miss the week after, you know, maybe the RPI will be in range. But I don't know. I don't see it right now. I feel like it's still just a three bid league.
And Southern Miss is kind of out of that as well, which is it's very understandable why Southern Miss is kind of on the outside looking in right now. Yeah, they have to go to Marshall, but yeah, they still have to play East Carolina. They still have to play at Tulane. And, you know, two-thirds of their rotation they expected to be there is not there from last year's academic stuff with Thompson and Jeffrey Thomas, and the other guy's last name is Thompson. So Thomas and Thompson.
Right.
You lose two-thirds of your weekend rotation, you're not going to be as good as you planned. There are very few programs that can overcome that. So I kind of understand why Southern Miss is a little bit down this year, but feels like that's a three-bid league,
young.
Aaron. You know?
Yeah, you're right. And Southern Miss is young. I mean, I think they're going to be very good in time, but you know, it's noteworthy that Southern Miss is probably going to miss regionals this year. I mean, maybe they'll get hot in the conference tournament like they've done before, and keep their streak going. But this team has been in regionals every year, you know, since I've been doing this. I think now it's, what is it, 8 straight years that they've
feels like it.
They've been in something like that. They've got a nice streak going. So, you know, at least one of those years they needed to get the automatic bid to get in. So maybe that's what they do this year too. But they don't strike me. I mean, you know, I just think Rice and UCF are a clear cut above everybody in this league, with East Carolina as a clear cut third team. And these other teams just strike me as just okay.
And it feels like again, great freshman class, but you got to have the contributions from the older guys. And that'll be the difference of the team like NC State. You know, will some of their veteran pitchers, you know, can step forward a little bit more consistently to complement Rodon and their lineup, Andrew Sensen and Danny Cannella and some of those guys, to complement Trey Turner and Brett Austin and Jake Fincher. We talked about with all these freshman teams, just not quite enough veteran help at Southern Miss for Mason Robbins, who's had this tremendous freshman year, and Connor Barron, who's been not quite as good as Mason Robbins, but you know, that very vaunted freshman class at Southern Miss, they just don't have quite enough veteran help around them. So the theme of today's podcast, Aaron, old. Good day, good week. It's a good time in college baseball for oldsters like me, right?
And, you know, and that's why a team like New Mexico State is having such a great year. You know, a team that's now been in our top 25 for a couple of weeks in a row. A lot of juniors and seniors in that lineup. You know, Sam Houston State is an older team, a lot of veterans on that team. I mean, these mid-majors that really jump forward, that's one thing that we're seeing is they got juniors and seniors. I mean, in that respect, it is like college basketball where, you know, a team like Butler can get to the national championship game because they've got an older team, you know, guys that have hung around, veteran players. I think you're right. That's the theme of this podcast, being old. Being old helps a lot in college sports.
Sam Houston State has a four-game lead. Again, that just tells you a little bit about just how spectacular, you know, what Baylor and Florida State are doing in those power conferences. They have bigger leads than Sam Houston State, which is having a tremendous year, has in the Southland. It's kind of remarkable. Aaron, Sam Houston State or New Mexico State, either of those teams, are those teams basically locks to be two seeds? And New Mexico State and Sam Houston State probably going to be two seeds at places like Rice and the winner of that A&M-Texas series, or maybe, I guess, New Mexico State gets sent to Arizona if Arizona is a one seed in the host. So that, yeah, is there a lot those teams can really do about that at this point?
That feels pretty much like what's going to happen. You know, I mean, you never know, I suppose, but, I mean, you know, let's be realistic. That's probably the way it's going
to
fall.
And that's the reason. I don't mean to slight those clubs, and Sam Houston State still has to go to Southeast Louisiana, which is their closest – I'm sorry, their home to Southeast Louisiana, and that is their closest pursuer in the league. They still got to go to Texas Arlington, which is also tied. So they still have to play the two teams that are tied for second, four games behind them. So, they could lose those series and not win the league, but it just seems like it still feels like even if they win out, it feels like their best-case scenario is a two-seed somewhere else because there's just not anything on their resume – outside of the league that screams, yeah, wow, Sam Houston State, they're going to be a number one seed. And same thing with New Mexico State.
They've got that nice series win very early against San Diego. I can't see them getting a host over, a team like Texas A&M, let's say, or Texas, you know, if those teams are on the periphery of the hosting discussion. I don't know what the facilities are like at Sam Houston State, but, I mean, they're not going to host over Texas or Texas A&M.
Now, New Mexico State, could they do anything with that? They are 21 in the RPI. They have that series win to start the year against Wake Forest. So you go and you beat an ACC team. That looks good. Now this weekend they're playing Baylor. I guess it does feel like New Mexico State, with that RPI, and they still have to go to Hawaii, Fresno, San Jose State, pretty good teams in the WAC. I guess it does feel like they have an outside shot of being a one seed. Am I crazy to think that?
No, I think you're right. I mean, it's fascinating to think about that. They're 30-11. You know, they're number 21 in the RPI. They do have some quality wins. They've got those wins against Arizona that we talked about, you know, those midweek wins, which is kind of the, that's really the centerpiece of their resume. But, they're a good club. And if they go to Baylor this week and, you know, let's say they win both those games at Baylor.
Yeah, just for the sake of argument, yeah.
I mean, all of a sudden, I think you got to take them seriously as a potential one seed.
I think you do. It would be crazy. It would be awesome for New Mexico State. It would be great for college baseball if someone from one of these other leagues, besides a UCF or a Conference USA kind of team, but a team like New Mexico State, and then again, we didn't talk about it in the podcast gone long, but Purdue, Aaron, we'll wrap up with Purdue. They go on the road. You profile both those teams in weekend preview, Purdue and Nebraska. They go to Lincoln and win 2 out of 3 against the Cornhuskers, pretty big series win for Purdue. It feels like the last piece of that is just where do they host, you know, but I feel like they have a shot. Still, if they can go and win that series at UCLA, I feel like they could be more than a host. I feel like they could be a top eight national seed if they win that series, can't they? They're 8 in the RPI right now.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? I think you're right. I think if they go to UCLA and win that series, that's what they're playing for, is a chance to be a national seed. Purdue. Which hasn't won a Big Ten in a century. I mean, more than a century.
Unbelievable.
It is unbelievable, but they're doggone good. And, you know, It's the star power. We talked a lot about the Kevin Plaweckis and the the Nick Whitgrins and the Cameron Perkins, and those guys get it done week after week, and that's what happened this week. They got big hits from their stars, Plaweki and Perkins, and they got a great relief outing from Whitgren. Three plus innings of scoreless work. I mean, it's their stars, and Joe Hayes and Lance Breedlove over the course of the season, and
yeah.
I mean, those their stars have carried them.
To use Whitgren that much on Sunday, Aaron, was that I watched the Friday game, and Blake Mascarello was really nice out of their bullpen.
Yeah.
He was composed.
Absolutely, you're right. It's a...
Pumped in a lot of strikes. Again, theme of the podcast. He threw a ton of strikes. He dared Nebraska to hit him, and they couldn't damage him. You know, so I really do think in the course of as this plays out, the BB Corps bats are going to wind up being really good for college baseball. Because more guys, I think, are going to go play college baseball with this new CBA, and pitchers are going to learn to throw strikes. They're going to learn to pitch to contact. And to me, this is a sidebar, but I think pitch to contact gets a bad name because here's what I think, and I'll have to run this by a pitching coach, but here's why pitching coaches say pitch to contact, Aaron. Because in the major leagues, you have to get strikes in the strike zone. You have to be a good major league pitcher. You have to get swings and misses in the zone. Hitters in the major leagues will not always bail you out by chasing like they will in college, in the minor leagues, even in the upper levels of the minor leagues. But that's the difference. Like, you watch AAA baseball, and when we saw David Price, I know I've told this story before, he could not get dudes to chase in AAA. That's why he struggled a little bit in AAA. That's why the changeup and the cutter are such great pitches. They look like fastballs that are going to be in the strike zone. And in the case of a changeup, it dies or you're out front and you still can get a swing and miss in the strike zone. Or a cutter, again, looks like a fastball. Then it winds up out of the strike zone. You're going to get swings and misses or you're going to get contact, weak contact. That's why those pitches work. So when a pitching coach says pitch to contact, what he's trying to get in a pitcher's mind is throw the ball in the doggone strike zone. And you're trying to drill that into people's heads. And the BB Corps bat, more than anything else in baseball probably in the last 40 years, will drill that into a young pitcher's head of throw strikes, pitch to contact, which really means throw the ball in the strike zone, because you'll be rewarded for it. So hopefully long term, that's what comes out of this BB Corps bat era is young pitchers learn to throw pitches in the strike zone and to pitch to contact. And the best way to throw strikes is to throw fastballs. And hopefully it's a cumulative effect that you throw more fastballs, therefore you command the fastball more, therefore you hopefully throw with better velocity because you're throwing more fastballs. And hopefully in the long term it builds on itself. I wonder if you have seen any evidence of that or heard any evidence of that in the last 2 years, but it just feels like pitchers like that who throw more strikes, and you're rewarded more for throwing more fastballs, it feels like, in this era.
Exactly. And you know what else is pitchers still need to learn that it's okay to throw the ball in the inner half and challenge hitters inside.
That's
and you've got a guy like Mark Appel who's got incredibly electric stuff, and he's had a nice year, but he hasn't had the kind of dominant year that you'd expect a guy with his stuff to have, and it's partly, I think, because he doesn't pitch inside. Everything is away, 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 away all year long.
Yeah.
He doesn't own the strike zone. I mean, with these bats especially, and with any kind of bat, if you're throwing in the mid-high 90s.
That's right.
Challenge the hitter. Go inside. I mean, and, you know, you can do that with a mid-80s fastball in college baseball and have a lot of success if you can locate.
And that's again, just locally, provincially, that is what makes Stroman and Rodon so special. I really think if you had top five pitchers in college baseball, those are two of the top five for me. And Stroman this year might be number one. I don't know. Who's the best pitcher in the game to you right now, Aaron? Who's the best pitcher in college baseball this year? Not best season, best pitcher.
I think it probably might be Marcus Stroman. John, I think you're right. I think that's who I'd go with.
I mean, Kevin Gausman's in that short list. He owns the strike zone a little bit more than Appel. I think right now, if I'm taking a college pitcher number one, and we've talked about that. I know I'm going on a tangent now and going too long, but got me on a roll. So it's your fault. But Appel, you just dogged on Appel, and I think those are legitimate criticisms of Mark Appel. Kyle Zimmer's stuff has been down of late, has it not, at San Francisco?
It was definitely down last week when I saw him down at LMU. I mean, you know, it was still he peaked at 94 early, kind of pitched around 90 after that. But you know, people love the breaking ball. It's a good slider and changeup. I mean, it's the makings of a quality four pitch repertoire. He's really athletic. I mean, there's a lot to like with Kyle Zimmer, but his stuff hasn't been as good as it was earlier on.
No doubt. Michael Wach is in that mix at Texas A&M. He wasn't great this weekend. We've already talked about, hey, Baylor's pretty doggone good. Baylor probably has something to do with that. You saw Michael Wach at his absolute best, did you not, at Pepperdine?
I did. Yeah, I did. That was the game that he had I think he had a perfect game into the eighth. You know, he's capable of certainly really dominating. I mean, with his size and velocity and that obviously that changeup, which is a real separator for him, and the fact that his breaking balls have improved too.
That's what she said. But I really do think, out of all those guys, I would take Kevin Gausman. The more things go this year, I'm wondering why does Kevin Gausman? I don't think that we're even guilty of it. I think we do always include Kevin Gausman in the discussion. Shouldn't Kevin Gausman be in this discussion for number one overall pick? I mean, he feels like he's just as good as those other guys, and he feels like he throws more strikes. And on top of it, he's got a guy in Alan Dunn as pitching coach this year. He's been in pro ball for a long time. Paul Maneri, been around college baseball a long time, but has a pretty decent track record of producing professional players, whether it was at Notre Dame or now at LSU, has a lot of contacts in pro ball. I'm starting to warm up to the idea of Kevin Gausman going 1-1, Aaron. Maybe I taught me off the ledge. Am I crazy, or is there how hard would you be looking at Kevin Gausman 1-1 if you were Jeff Luhnow?
I mean, he's just as good as any of those guys and maybe better. I mean, as you know, the thing about Gausman is that he's not always dominant either. I mean, I feel like he's had several of these games where he's gone, you know, seven innings, eight innings, giving up four runs. I mean, he's had a number of games where he's been hit a little bit, you know. I mean, it's not like he's really overpowering hitters, and that's the problem, is there isn't really a guy out there who's having a Trevor Bauer kind of a season, or David Price when he was a junior, or
right.
A Strasburg. I mean, there's none of the top guys are having top-of-the-line seasons. I think Marcus Stroman is having an elite season, regardless of his win-loss record. I mean, that just shows you how flawed that stat is, because Marcus Stroman has been utterly dominant week after week.
Gausman does have 88 strikeouts in 69 innings. I mean, he's given up some hits. You know, he's given up some extra base hits. He's given up a lot of doubles. Feels like he's been more dominant and he's in the better league. I guess I'm wondering how much does that being in the Southeastern Conference, how much do we give him? And he's got to have Jordy Snickers behind the plate. That gives him some wings to lift him up the rankings. Greek mythology joke of the day. It just feels like maybe we have not done that enough. Maybe it's up to me and Jim and Connor on the draft side. Haven't talked up Gausman enough. But, I mean, I feel like that's pretty – and what he did against Kentucky, as hot as Kentucky has been, I feel that's as good as anything these other guys have done. You know, 11 strikeouts in 7 innings, and he only walked one. And his walk strikeout numbers are pretty good. I mean, it's 4-1. It's getting close to 5-1 strikeout-to-walk ratio. I'm warming up to Kevin Gausman being right in the heart of that discussion as much as anybody.
Yeah, I mean, and again, like I said this even in the chat last week, I think he is right in the heart of that discussion. Absolutely. I don't think there's any difference between him and Appel and Zimmer at this point. Or, you know, you could throw Walker and Stroman in there if you want to have five names. You can put those guys in a lot of different orders, and I would be fine if he had Gausman at the top. And I'll let you know more next week when I see Gausman down at LSU.
That's the last thing, too long of a podcast, but you're heading down to SEC country for your first trip beyond Columbia, South Carolina, which is our easiest drive from the Raleigh-Durham area. Where are you headed this week? Tell people where they can see the Aaron Fit experience.
Yeah, I'll be at Baton Rouge on Friday, maybe Saturday, and then going to head up to Starkville for the last game or two of that Ole Miss-Mississippi State series. So I'll be around, I think, for a midweek game Tuesday as well at Pearl between the Rebels and Southern Miss. So I'll see four games over the course of a few days. Should be a good trip.
I think you're going to have to interview Ray Frimes about hitting 537 games in.
Crazy, isn't
that
it?
That is ridiculous. I mean, I knew he was still hitting over 450. I didn't realize he had the kind of weekend where he's hitting 500, over 140 at-bats. That's first-team All-America territory. That might be – that's Dave Magadan territory is where that is. I think Dave Magadan – Didn't he hit 513 back in 1983? Maybe he hit 481.
I think you're right, John.
Something like that. I think Dave Maggin is the last time I can remember a dude having that kind of a year. I do know, sticks out to me that my first year at BA in 1997, my first college season, that I believe Adam Kennedy hit 479 at Cal State Northridge. I still think that's he may have actually hit – there may have been a dude who hit 481, like at Fordham, since then. But that's kind of the peak. And actually, I guess the year before, I think Pat Burrell hit 484 as a freshman. But, of course, those were all with the minus five bats. I'd be curious to know what the best batting average is since 1999 when the bats went back to minus threes. Does a number stick out in your head, Aaron? That would he be challenging a 480 kind of season?
You know, there've been some great seasons. What did Ricky Weeks hit his great year?
That's a great call. I have to look that up. I have to type faster than I do on my iPad to figure that one out and look that one up. But I mean,
The answer is Ricky Weeks hit 497 in 2002 and 483 in 2003.
493 in 2003.
497.
497.
In 2002. 483 in 2003.
That's
so he
crazy.
Slumped as a junior.
That dude was so good. It's just so much fun. I got a feature on Quintavious Drains that'll come out this week. And excuse me, it's a lot of fun to talk to people in the SWAC because for me, it always comes back to those early 2000s Southern teams. And one of the reasons is that the assistant coaches and the players off those teams are scattered throughout the SWAC, and even players on other teams, coaches on other teams have former Roger Cador players who are assistant coaches. And Coach Cador has been in that league for so long, and Jackson State's dominating that league. And so you have that to look forward to this week as well. As I talked down to the man, the myth, the legendary name, Quintavious Drains, and tried to put a little person behind the name, and that was a lot of fun, Aaron. And Quintavious, with his seventh complete game this weekend, leads the nation. he beat, I forget who they beat, Alcorn this weekend, coached by former Southern assistant Barrett Ray, and the defending league champion. So Jackson State kind of rolling through the SWAC. We'll see if they can – obviously the tournament is what really matters in the SWAC in terms of a national picture, but it just feels like Jackson State could win a game or two in a regional because they have Quintavious. He's awesome, and he's like 9-2. And then they have this 5'8", Des Russell, 5'8", right-handed pitcher, the Bahamian Marcus Stroman, as I'm going to call him from now on, who is their other – he's their number two starter. And these two guys are – been very competitive, and they've really dominated the SWAC, and I think that you have two starters like that. It makes things interesting when you get into the postseason. Go ahead.
And they steal a ton of bases, as usual. They just put a lot of pressure on you with their speed, and that's a separator for them as well, I think.
I agree. No, it's hard to – you're going to have a hard time getting scouting reports on Omar Johnson's club in Jackson State, and I think they're going to be competitive. Yeah, I think they're going to be more – I think this is the year where the SWAC team – is actually going to be the more competitive team in postseason play as opposed to the MEAC where it's been Bethune-Cookman for years. But too long podcast. Aaron, I got rolling the last 20 minutes, started pacing around. I don't know why, but I got all geeked up, and I appreciate you playing along. And Aaron, you're going down to SEC country for the first time this weekend. You got to be geeked for that trip.
Yeah, I'm fired up. It's going to be a lot of fun. I've been waiting to see the new Alex Box Stadium for a long time. It's way overdue, so... I am fired up, John. Not as fired up as you are at the end of a podcast, pacing around the room, but close.
Well, eat some gumbo for me, and remember that this Baseball America College podcast is sponsored by ATEC, the baseball training machine company. At ATEC, we're committed to delivering tools to coaches to help train, and my screen just went out on my iPad. We're committed to delivering tools to coaches to help train and develop players. Visit ATECsports.com to learn about training machines that can help make your practice more effective and efficient. See training tips and practice drills from Vanderbilt head coach Tim Corbett and more on ATECsports.com. ATEC, win every practice. For Aaron Fitt, I'm John Manuel. We'll see you next time on another loopy edition of the Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.